This book really is about what people do when they feel like they have no choices. And so early on, the family is faced with some very difficult moments. They fear they're going to lose their farm. And then there's another piece that pushes them over the edge. And it ultimately, they are saved by a very wealthy church member who provides a loan, pulls the family from the brink, literally of living in a ditch, starvation. And so in the short term, everybody wins because the family can stay on the farm and it stays intact. But in the end, everybody loses. The benefactor gains a foothold into the family. The son goes off and works for this man and gains lots of new ideas. And the father feels like he no longer is the provider, and it's everybody loses. And what happens throughout the book then is that it's just a slow discovery that this man is not who people think he is. And so that's where the book goes. He's very charismatic. He is very generous. He has this wonderful, warm spirit to him. And even the best people can have a dark side.
Tell me about the title, Never Enough Flamingos.
Yeah. It's a reference to the mother, to Mama, who was a flamingo in a sea of turkeys. She saw things that people didn't see. She had intuition. Now, just because you see things doesn't mean you act on them. But we all should be more flamingo-like in whatever it is that we do.
What was the spark or the impetus behind this story?
This story, I was pregnant with this story for 30 years before I ever wrote it. The seeds of this story started in 1970. My sister had an assignment. She was a freshman in college. She had an assignment to interview family members and create a family history. So I tagged along with her. She went to interview our grandfather, the only living grandparent we had at the time. And she was asking him questions about World War I and World War II and what was it like in the Dust Bowl and the Depression and all of this. And he sat there and he told us these stories. And he talked about the dust clouds rolling over the hills and picking up so much dust that at night they would go to bed with a wet kerchief over their mouths and wake up to rings of dust around it. Or there'd be an inch of dust on the windowsills. And it was whatever the dust storms didn't take away, the grasshoppers finished. And the family was poverty-stricken. They lived on the edge through those years. And the only thing that kept them from truly starving was that they had a small herd of milk cows, five or six. And my grandpa started telling the story where he walked out to the pasture one night to bring in the milk cows, and he didn't see them in the field. And then he looked up, and he saw the buzzards circling. And as he came over the knoll, there was a small herd of milk cows, dead and bloated by the creek. They'd gotten into some loco weed, and they had died. And as he told this story, 40 years after it happened, he began to sob, and he cried into his hands, and he said, "I didn't know how I was going to provide for my family. I didn't know." And to see him be so emotionally moved about that moment, 40 years after the fact, he still couldn't talk about it without sobbing. It wasn't just tears, it was sobbing. I knew that was going to be a story for me that I had to write about. So that was really the beginning. And literally for the next 30 years, this story played around in my head. And there were other components. The book is about sexual abuse too. And those stories came from, we're women. We all know women who have experienced that. And men too, but primarily women. And as I listened to those stories over the years, I thought, here are these farmers who had no means to provide for their family. And what did they have? They had sons and daughters. And what choices did they make so that they could keep the family farm, so they didn't have to go live in a ditch, so that they wouldn't be destitute? And I think this sort of thing happened then a lot more than people admitted. You know, we often just don't want to know. And so the story also parallels what was happening in Europe at the time. And so if you think about, people didn't want to know what was happening to the Jews either. Because if you knew, then you had to do something. And if you knew about these daughters, you had to do something.
Tell me about the protagonist in your book, Kat Peters.
One of the Kirkus reviews called her sarcastic, and I was kind of disappointed because I don't like that word. I think she's pretty honest, and she's self-deprecating. I think self-deprecating is a much better word than sarcastic, but I didn't tell Kirkus reviews that. So she starts at about age 6 or 7, and by the end of the trilogy, because this is a trilogy, there are 2 more books after this, and by the end of the trilogy, she is 20, 21, something like that. And it's a coming-of-age story for her, what she experiences, and what she experiences with her friends who have also experienced Simon Yoder, the benevolent and not so benevolent, generous man. And she's pretty independent, and I like that. She's got a lot of spunk. Mm-hmm. And she's, so I grew up Mennonite. This is about Mennonites. And so there's a lot of Janelle in Kat in terms of her theology and her perspective about organized religion. And at the end of the day, she still embraces what she grows up with, and yet there are so many ways where she knows it's not right. A lot of people look at Mennonite in there and they think, oh, you know, I don't want to read this. Or they'll say, so is this typical of Mennonites, you know, sexual abuse? And what I always say is, it's no more and no less typical than any other group. The way I look at this is I have a metaphor that the Mennonite part of the story is the print on the fabric. And that print could be Catholic. We know it can be Catholic. It could be Baptist. It could be Mormons. It could be really any social construct where there's hierarchy and power. So the print can be anything, but the warp and the weave are about power and hierarchy. And anytime you have that, you have people who are vulnerable, and they are always children and often women. I've had some amazing discussions in book clubs that I've gone to where we start talking about women and women in the 30s and even women today, and how there is a hierarchy in so many theologies. And Mennonites, certainly in the 30s, were very much that way. Today, not necessarily. It varies by congregation to congregation. But it's, my congregation has a female pastor, and I love her dearly. But even today, there's quite a women should be silent, they should be submissive. I was just at a book club last week, and one of the women was talking about a Mennonite church that had burned down in the area. And when they were rebuilding it, there wasn't a single woman on the committee to design the kitchen. And now we're talking about probably a group of men who wouldn't be able to find the silverware drawer, and they would have never picked up a tea towel, but yet they knew. Where were the women, where were the men in that congregation? Why weren't they saying, what? What? Certainly in the 30s, there was a mindset that the dumbest man is more capable than the smartest woman, and that gets people into trouble.
Janelle, do you have an excerpt you can read for me?
Yeah. I come from a long line of storytellers, which isn't my fault. The burden of this is that I can never just tell you something. I have to give you the context that frequently begins with, I was born in a small town in Kansas just before the Depression. You'd be surprised how often that bit of information is important. When we were children, you could have asked me and my brother Ben what we had for supper, and he, who somehow escaped the family curse, would have told you, potatoes and ham gravy. 4 words. Of course, it lacks detail, substance, and nuance, even if it does actually answer your question. I, on the other hand, would have felt driven to tell you about the drought, the price of pork, the relatives who gave up and moved to California, and the surprising ways you can stretch something into not much, but enough to get full on. I'd eventually remember to circle around and tell you about the potatoes and ham gravy, but that'd be after I also told you about the piano lessons I never got but always wanted, and the fact that my brother was a terrible speller and for his entire life spelled women weemone. Ben used to say, when you ask Cat, that's me, something, you better have your knitting along. I've speculated about why Ben doesn't talk much. Back in the 20s, we used to have bands of gypsies that will jangle along the back roads between here and nowhere worth going. I think they stole Ben from some dull Lutheran family up north in Pawnee County. And when they realized he was never going to be able to distract people with any witty conversation, they dropped him off on our doorstep, thinking we Mennonites would never even notice he was boring. I showed up after he did, so although my mother always denied my version of things, I'm not convinced. Of course, I'm only telling you this, so you'll forgive me if I tell you more than Ben would offer about that awful day in the early 30s when the Sweet Home Bank closed, which was really the start of things. In fact, if you want Ben's version of those years, here it is. The Depression nearly destroyed us. The war was worse. My version? Well, I think you need to know a little more.
That's Janelle Diller reading from Never Enough Flamingos. You mentioned that this is the first in a trilogy.
Yes.
What's ahead for Kat?
Well, this book takes place during the Depression. And the next book, Never Enough Sisters, which has been released, it takes us the next step. In the story, the characters stay the same, and it really just picks up where it left off with the first book. It takes place during the pre-war years and bumping up right against the war. And then the third book, Never Enough Lilacs, is about what happens during World War II. And if people don't know very much about Mennonites, in many ways, Mennonites are like Presbyterians. But the distinguishing characteristic is that Mennonites are pacifists. And so there's a lot of tension around how do you live your faith, and I think what was important to me as I wrote this is that we often compartmentalize so that our values on a micro level are often not the same values that we have on a macro level. And so while we would never get into a fight with a neighbor, we never would. We have no trouble being aggressive with countries and feeling very righteous about it. So I really want people to think about that. And wherever they come out, they'll come out. But I think they need to travel that path a little bit and at least think about, well, what does this mean? What are my values? The book starts with a very clunky sentence full of noun clauses. How you get to where you don't know you're going determines where you end up. And this whole trilogy is about the choices that you make. And if you make them based on your values, you will end up where you should be. If you make your choices based on other people's values or public pressure or whatever, you might not end up where you want to be. And I think, again, that's true on a personal level. And these days, it's very true on a national level.
That's a lovely sentiment.
Thank you.